First up this afternoon, we have the Experience Rochester annual update. I assume, Mr. Jones, you're going to lead off?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You come back from Washington just for this.
Greetings. We have a video that I'm going to play here. Brent's going to help me play. I'm going to pass out the annual report to you while that's playing. So, as we can go.
I'm your witness.
My kids have taught me anything. Alexa, volume.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Brad, you'd maybe just hum along or something.
Right. Exactly. Conceptualize amazing use of.
I'm going to begin talking just because there's no music, but believe me, there is beautiful music set to this. We'll post this video to your to our website, and all of you can use it. It's a wonderful kind of recap of not only overview of the city visually, but some of the great statistics of our visitor economy that you're welcome to use, and certainly give us a call if you ever want to multi-purpose that. But first of all, I'd like to start with a thank you, really to underscore that Rochester is truly an exceptional destination for visitors. Our team at Experience Rochester is very grateful and honored to be the city's destination management organization. But really, we try to move our visitor economy forward each and every day. We're grateful to our community and our hospitality industry for being welcoming and inclusive to our 3.3 million annual visitors who come to Rochester. And especially our workforce of 14,000 hardworking citizens who strive to provide an excellent visitor experience each and every day. We continue to be poised for many growth opportunities that are before us, and I look forward to discussing those with you today and taking a few moments of your meeting to share information contained in our annual report, which I brought with me. And that you maybe had an opportunity to read this weekend in your council packet. Our annual report to the community is really designed to communicate and share some of our highlights and accomplishments from the last year. Our current board of directors is listed on page 4. Our chairman, Myron Sauls, is with us today. And our staff members are listed on page 23. These hardworking, dedicated colleagues and volunteers are incredible examples of community service, and continue to reach new heights that we once never thought were achievable. Our mission at Experience Rochester is to stimulate economic growth through visitor spending with aggressive sales, marketing, partnerships, destination development strategies, while facilitating the best possible visitor experience. A few of the specifics that I will briefly highlight today with you are some of our recent sales results and efforts, marketing programs, our new branding strategy, destination brand, new business generation, the importance of conventions, meetings, and sports events in Rochester. I'd like to start with the infographic, which is on page 3 of the annual report. This infographic really articulates the strategic direction of Experience Rochester. Attracting strategic events, raising the destination awareness, raising the quality of life, improving transportation networks and infrastructure, and enhancing the visitor experience. We believe that this best represents the important cornerstone strategies at Experience Rochester today and in the future. Overall, 2017 and year-to-date 2018, the visitor business in Rochester saw rapid growth and was record-setting. On page 5, 6, and 7 of the annual report, you will see that our sales efforts have found unprecedented levels, exceeding expectations on an ongoing basis. In the last 12 months, our team has sold an amazing 514 total future events into Rochester. These events will produce $84 million in future spending and $4.6 million in Mayo Civic Center revenue. One important role that you look to us to fulfill is the sales and marketing agency for the Mayo Civic Center. We're thrilled to report to you that in 2017, the sales team sold $3.6 million in future Mayo Civic Center revenue, which exceeded the $3.4 million goal. In the first 6 months of 2018, our sales team continues to be above pace with almost $2 million in Mayo Civic Center sales, on our way to yet setting another new normal. As you know, a major benefit of the new facilities at the Mayo Civic Center has been our ability to attract new business to Rochester. In just the last 18 months, the sales team has booked 127 new events into the Mayo Civic Center, bringing more than 45,000 new visitors to Rochester and $12 million in new spending. You can see a few of those new groups highlighted on page 6 of the annual report. It is worth stating that the new facilities have also provided a much better event experience for our attendees. You will be delighted to hear that our team is seeing very high levels of retention and have been successful in surpassing our goal of 90% higher rate of rebooking our base events for the future. Obviously, destination sales for conventions, meetings, and events is ultra competitive, and we're thrilled with some of the new efforts from 2017 and beginning in the months of 2018. Specifically, listed on page 6, the sales team attended many industry trade shows and sales activities all over North America. These trade shows and missions created nearly 250 new prospects for the city. Obviously, we love to celebrate all this great success that we're having in sales, but it is equally important to understand why we lose business as well. We track our lost business on an ongoing basis and report each month who we lost, why, and who we lost to. On page 7, you will see a snapshot of the main reasons why we lose business, and it's imperative that you and other leaders are in tune with this and can assist to remove some of the barriers that exist to have continued growth of our business. Our marketing team's primary role is to create destination demand. In 2017 and the beginning half of 2018, our marketing team have been extraordinarily busy for our marketing efforts. Many of these highlights are discussed on pages 10 through 13 of the annual report. In 2017, we developed a new brand partnership, and through extensive research and collaboration, we launched a new destination and organizational brand strategy, which we shared with you earlier this year. The new brand strategy speaks clearly to our market targets, our target markets, and straightforward content promoting the city's true essence. Obviously, with the development of the new brand strategy comes a new and robust marketing plan that includes fine-tuning many of our existing programs, but we have also launched several initiatives and new tactics. Included in that was the recent launch of our new responsive website that is at the heart of our mobile-first strategy. Utilizing fresh, revolving content, search engine optimization, and powerful and dramatic imagery, this website has become an incredible new welcome mat for Rochester with an average of over 25,000 unique users each month. As you can imagine, the last year has kept us very busy collaborating with the Mayo Civic Center on a comprehensive marketing plan specific to the MCC's new needs. Some of these deliverables include new collateral material, video testimonials, development of new professional photo assets, including 360-degree photo tours, a new facility brand, content, ramped up social media, and many new business generation initiatives. In the next year, we look forward to also rebuilding the Mayo Civic Center website. New media channels enabled by the internet continue to reinvent our industry and provide us with opportunities to communicate with our visitors, consumers, and customers. We have invested greatly in social media channels, blog sites, and electronic newsletter tactics that will continue to be an evolving way to target demand growth and really manage the visitor experience with our visitor. You can see our social media channels, tactics, and results on page 12 of the annual report. As exciting as digital marketing world is, we realize that traditional marketing tools continue to be equally effective. We have recently completed a comprehensive user analysis of our visitor guide. We call that Experience Rochester, which is our complete guide to Rochester, which is distributed direct to the future visitor information requests displayed in all Rochester hotel rooms and distributed at several brochure racks in and around Rochester. This research and information has really led us to formalize a new publishing agreement with Green Spring Media. They have extensive experience in this world, and through our new partnership, it will allow us to deepen our reach and broaden our distribution of Experience Rochester. All told, the execution of our new marketing plan accounts for hundreds of new prospects and nearly a million new impressions each and every month on an ongoing basis. Experience Rochester has continued also many important destination development priorities by formulating, recommending, and supporting strategies to gain tourism market share and stimulate economic growth. These are listed on page 14 through 17. Partnerships like the new Convention Center project, Destination Medical Center expansion, and the Diversity of Air Service at RST, Explore Minnesota Tourism, Brand USA International Marketing, our hospitality partnership with the Chamber, Arts and Cultural Initiatives, Rochester Downtown Alliance, and our Grand Park redevelopment plans are a few of the key ongoing initiatives and partnerships. The downtown landscape is changing dramatically, I don't need to tell you, and by the end of 2020, we will add an additional 850 hotel rooms to the downtown corridor, which will be transformative for our hospitality industry. On page 18 and 19 of the annual report, we highlight our Rochester Sports Partnership. Our nationally recognized premier sports event management organization continues to drive the Rochester economy by attracting and administering sports events, which in 2017 provided over $25 million in economic impact through an amazing 102 events. These events brought 140,000 visitors and 50,000 sports participants who consumed over 35,000 hotel room nights. Many of these events provide Rochester with an exciting opportunity to showcase our city to the nation. In the last year, we've hosted an inordinate number of national championships, including the Division III NCAA Women's Basketball Championship, USA Softball, USA Wrestling, USA Baseball, National Junior Collegiate Volleyball, and a few competitive dance national championships. Visitor experience also plays an important role in our overall strategic plan. Our comprehensive training program provides a custom training and retraining process for our hospitality professionals. The MyRochesterExperience.com survey provides us ongoing monitoring and measurements of the overall visitor experience. And our one-of-a-kind citywide service recovery portal provides us real-time comments and feedback with the opportunity to share and address these instantaneously. 2018 brings our seventh year of the Certified Tourism Ambassador Program. You can see on page 20 and 21 of the annual report that since our CTA program's inception, we've trained over 1,600 individuals in Rochester as CTAs. We had 125 complete the certification in 2017, and we've had over 150 people who have been active with CTA for all or every year of the program's history. The more than 1,600 CTAs trained is significant because the program requires a fee as well as a commitment to read the curriculum, attend a tour, attend a four-hour classroom session, and pass an open book test and maintain an annual recertification process. I'd like to also ask you all to take an opportunity sometime here in the next month when you're out and about to thank one of our many community hosts who wear the green vests and volunteer their time to welcome visitors, answer questions, provide directional assistance, and inform and encourage our visitors to get out and experience Rochester. We just finished our seventh full year of operating our five self-service interactive touchscreen kiosks as well. I'm thrilled to report that our usership continues to be robust. In 2017, we had over 35,000 user sessions. And you'll recall, in 2016, we placed a new kiosk at the airport, and in 2017, we expanded the network with a new kiosk at the all-new Mayo Civic Center. Later this year, we will incorporate our new brand within the look of the kiosks with a comprehensive redesign. I'd like to finish my remarks with a reminder of the economic impact of the hospitality industry in Rochester. We continue to be the city's second largest industry with 14,800 full-time jobs. $1.2 billion in economic impact by our more than 3.3 million annual visitors. Nearly 70% of our visitors come from Mayo Clinic, while just over 15% come from conventions, meetings, and sports. Groups mean business, and in Rochester's case, these conventions, meetings, and sports events are a $70-plus million annual business. Last month, our annual audit report was delivered to the city, and we continue to provide monthly sales reports and marketing reports containing all the leads, booked events, and lost business report, monthly marketing reports, as well as financial statements to our city staff representatives and city council representatives. I'd also like to reemphasize that our staff and board always open and available to each and every one of you for any questions on an ongoing basis, and more so for your suggestions. Please contact them, and they are always willing to meet with you and discuss anything, anytime. Lastly, as most of you know, these are my last few days with Experience Rochester. I've accepted a new position as Executive Director of Visit Bellevue in Washington State, beginning in September. Mary Gassner will be our interim executive director beginning on the 16th, and she will do an excellent job during the transition before our board conducts a formal search later this year. I'd like to thank each and every one of you, as well as previous council members, and I've been so fortunate to work with all of you for the last 13 years here in Rochester. Thanks for your ongoing support, partnership, trust, and leadership. Please know that it's been a true honor to serve the city.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey.
Thank you for the update. I just want to say how much we appreciate all you've done for the city of Rochester. The job you've done has been tremendous, and you will be missed. So good luck in your new endeavor, and thanks again for all you've done for Rochester.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Mr. Vildebeck.
Brad, thank you for your service, but I got a couple of questions. They're in here. I talked about other event areas, some of the hotels. And you talked about pretty much how much you do at the Civic Center. How much of that goes to other venues around the city?
Yeah, I would say, without running a report on that, which we can do and get back to you, I would say about a little more than half, or around half, goes to the Mayo Civic Center. The rest of the half goes to other venues throughout the city. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're meetings or conventions. You have to factor in their sporting events as well. So I would say the Mayo Civic Center gets less than probably 20% of our sports events, but probably somewhere around half or maybe 60% of our conventions and meetings.
And do you expect to see that increase with the new venues coming on site, or do you think that we should still see about a 50-50 split?
Yeah, it's a really good question. There is new competition in the market, and that will have somewhat of a profound effect on a certain size business. Anything that's about 300 people and below, that'll be the sweet spot for the new Hilton. Not unlike the Kaler Grand, the Hilton does have new meeting space, and they have more meeting space than the Kaler and Marriott. But it certainly adds a new competitive element to the marketplace. Our sales team has already witnessed that. There are events looking, and so we have to lean very heavily on our process to get through that. And our process is very straightforward. We solicit leads for the city, and we put those out to all of our partners, and we supply all the hotel options and all the venue options, and then our customer or the client makes the decision on where they want to stay. So we will do nothing new in that regard, but we do anticipate to lose business at the Mayo Civic Center for 300 and less attendees. Now, the object of that, of course, is to pick up the volume. And if you pick the volume up, we should be able to place a business on top of each other in the market. So prime dates will be key, and then filling those prime dates and then going after additional groups during that timeline. Our biggest fear right now isn't necessarily the meeting space or the competition. It's the number of committable rooms for groups downtown. We're seeing rates grow exponentially, and so it's pricing groups out of the downtown epicenter right now. That's why the new supply will be very important to the downtown to keep up with that volume. So I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor.
Well, I'll join the group too, but thank you for all that you've done. I've had the joy and the privilege to partner with you and with the visitor experience with the CTA classes that I've been able to get to a lot of them to welcome that group. But you've made a difference, a positive difference in the community, and I appreciate what you've done. Best wishes. You're moving to a nice place. I've been out there a few times myself with a friend, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor. I've learned a lot from you, and you've been a mentor to all of our staff, and you've been wonderful. So thanks for your service as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Campion.
Yeah, I'm just... got going really rapid at the end, and I just wanted to make sure. So there was a submission to administration of the 2018 objectives. Because I just want to make sure, because part of this is making sure we're set for next year, and I think it was by September we're supposed to have the planning documents for at a committee of the whole meeting for 2018 targets. But, and I didn't see it in here. I just wasn't sure if we got that separately or that's coming separately.
So I'll follow up with Mary on that, but most likely that'd be separately then.
Okay.
This.
All right. Yeah. And we should check that, because partly is like getting the cadence right with future meetings. Is I think at the same time we're looking back, it helps to look forward, because I don't know how significant they are yet, because we won't know until we get into the year about how those targets are changing, especially if we're factoring in the loss of business in a certain range, what that means for our targets in other areas. Just kind of interested to see that.
Yeah, so three documents that to keep your eye on. We have our strategic plan, and embedded in that is a marketing plan. Now, our board has switched from an annual plan. We just approved a 3 to 5 year plan last year, and so there'll be tweaks, of course, to that. So that's our strategic plan and our marketing plan. I think what you may be referring to is our goal setting process. And so the staff will be starting that goal-setting process very soon. It's a collaborative goal-setting process that will eventually make its way up to you through the governance bodies. And that'll be completed in October.
Okay.
And that'll set the stage for 2018 expectations.
Yeah, and the only reason I bring it up is as we went through this contract process, we call out specifically that we need a marketing plan for the year, and then that needs to include things like conventions, meetings, trade shows, sports, revenue goals, number of event days. So like that stuff, it's okay to have that five-year plan. I think as we solidify and we reevaluate the coming year, it'd be nice to get it in yearly increments, because that's how we're kind of looking back. We're not looking back at the five-year plan. So as we do that, I think that would be helpful, specifically probably as a part of this document when it comes forward again. Otherwise, congratulations on the new opportunity, and looking forward to having additional people kind of join in the mix and help us move forward in the community.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else? Well, once again, for the group, on behalf of the group, Brad, congratulations on the job well done. I know the Experience Rochester is in good hands. We have a great community, and you've set the bar pretty high, and we look to continue forward. So best wishes in your new endeavor. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brad.
All right. Moving on to our second topic, which is the parking rate study. Chris is going to lead off, or Tony, or who else?
Well, thank you, Mayor and Council members. We are bringing this back to you at a meeting prior to my arrival in Rochester. This was first discussed back on June 4th. We've got our team here to bring this back after the Council had requested some further discussion. In the meantime, as we'll discuss, we have had a chance to survey some of the stakeholders and kind of evaluate from some of the base options and alternates and bringing back a recommendation. So with that, I'll turn it over to our transit and parking manager, Tony Knauer, and ask Tony to introduce the team that's here today.
Okay. I want to refer to my memo, and before we get started here, I'm sure if you just go off to everyone, Steve, I'll
yeah.
Pack it. Okay. So what we're looking for is on the 20th, we'd like to present the rate study for adoption. We are recommending at this time to not proceed with the event, but that's something that I'm sure we'll want to discuss. We look to coming back to discuss the event at the effort, consulting with some of the other stakeholders, the Civic Center, the library, and some of the other downtown partners. But I thought first we'd start out with just going through the survey and what we found out. And then we'd like to also then go over the rate study, and not all of the slides we showed you last time, but some of the more important ones. So.
Thanks, Tony. Members of Council, I'll take just a second to review the rate study or the survey that we conducted. Subsequent to the June 4th meeting, we were asked to hear the voices of additional stakeholders from the downtown area, so we engaged with the Downtown Alliance to access their 380-plus list of stakeholders. We had about 103 responses. They divided up approximately this way, the majority being downtown employees, but a good representation of business owners as well. Those business types roughly break down to professional services, retail, and hospitality and dining. So, getting into the questions, first and foremost, we asked, do you support charging a flat fee for weekend and evening parking? And I think a 2-to-1 margin showed that they were not in support of this fee. And not surprising, when we asked if the $2 to $4 fee was too high or too low, most thought it was either too high, very few, but a small majority thought perhaps it was too low. Moving ahead, we also asked them about the event parking. And again, on a 2-to-1 margin in this case, the downtown stakeholders were in favor of an event parking fee, with a little bit larger number being undecided. By the way, these are expressed in percentages, but with about 100 respondents, you can imagine it's a 1-to-1 ratio in the number of respondents. So, then regarding the event parking fee, the thoughts on whether that $5 to $7 range, 5 being year 1, 7 year 5, whether it was too low or too high. Most thought it was about right or a little too high. You can see the results. Regarding their concerns, what's holding people back from being in favor of these? Overwhelmingly, the cost was for the employees. A lot of the service industry jobs are not high-paying jobs, and so there was some concern for those evening workers in some additional costs for parking downtown. And again, the second being the cost for customer. Regarding the other, which is a large majority, I've summarized those responses here. There was people who expressed this thought that it will just deter people from coming down. People are going to be unwilling to come downtown. And then the second biggest was those who responded, both employees and customers. So again, none of these responses are too surprising. Then the final question of the survey was, do you have any overall comments about the rate study? Again, those comments, as I tallied them, the number one response was the cost for low-wage employees. Close second was the overall amount of parking. There seemed to be concern that there wasn't adequate parking downtown. Then the fewer and fewer response, things like proposed rates too high. Some people said they were too low. And then some concerns about transit. So that's the results of the survey. And I think next coming up, we have Phil from Walker Consultants to go through the base case. But I guess if there's any questions about the survey, we can take a second to address that.
Any questions at this point, Mr. Vilbeck?
Just quick, when I noticed in here, some of the responses were the fact that they felt parking rates were too high for those who are attending the library. Are we working to look to see if there's a voucher system that might be set up there to encourage that use?
Well, it's been a few years. We have had some discussions about what would we do with the library, particularly in the event we were more focused on events.
Yeah.
You know, we've really come up with a solution. You know, one problem with that is that people might just go into the library and get validated or whatever and come back out. I'm not sure. But that's part of the reason to hold up on at least on the event parking. Seems like there's support for it. But just to get through some of those logistics of it, how's that going to affect the library? Should we make an exception for that? I think those are questions that are on the table. And then the size of the event. We haven't defined that, whether it's an event with 1,000 attendees or 500. I think for the rate study, we used something like, looking for 300 or something like that.
Yeah, there were 30,000 units parked cars for events at $5 a rate. So
there's a lot more than that. Okay.
Anyway, I just want to make sure that we continue to look at the library issue because that's come up before. So I'd like to see something done. One way or the other.
As Tony said, that's one of the reasons to hold off on event. And there's a lot of different pieces that we want to do.
Okay.
That's on our list.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Woodruff.
So some of us have been asking about event and parking for about 10 years now. And how long are we going to keep holding off on this? I mean, you've got the public on board. And, you know, everyone likes free parking, except no such thing exists. It's just other revenue sources are going to fill in gaps. So it's really a matter of, you know, particularly, there are times the library is closed. Sunday evenings, for example. I understand. We have the constituents on board that this is a good thing. It can help us fund some of our programming. At what point will we actually get to a point where we can act on this? I mean, how long are we looking? Is it?
I'm hoping we come back this fall. I think that we could work through those issues.
So that's a good thing to understand. There's a big difference between holding off for a couple months and holding off for the next cycle. So you know, I do understand that, and I mean it.
Yeah, the thought is not on the next cycle.
Well, like I say, it's been, I think Mark and I have been asking about that for about 10 years now to help support the Down by the Riverside concerts, and we've gotten nowhere. So I can't speak for him, but my patience is worn thin on it a little bit. A little bit, some of these questions. When you ask people if you want to pay for something that's currently free, and they come back with their answer is no, was there any sort of education or reasoning that was given to them at the front end of the study so at least they knew why we were doing it?
We try, you know, any of those questions, because everyone talks about we need more parking.
Yeah.
And that more parking is going to be provided by revenues.
Yeah.
So this system depends on those revenues. think in the beginning of the survey we mentioned that expansion and improvements to the facilities are really dependent on these revenues. So
that was my take in reading this. In terms of the evening and weekend parking, as long as there's capacity there and we're not up against capacity constraints, I could get off on, around holding off on that until, we actually needed that space at that time, which would be a good time to put fees in place. But, I think people need to understand that all that's really doing is it's shifting it to the other fees because the utility has to sustain itself. So it's not really free, it's just other people are paying it at different times. And that's, I appreciate the input. I was actually pleasantly surprised on the event parking. I think it makes a lot of sense, and it seems like the public's there with us, too.
I don't know if Brad's still here, but we've discussed that with the convention bureau. We're very supportive of the event parking as well.
So. All right. Anyone else?
We've already presented this information, so I want to make sure that we're focusing on what's most important today and not waste anybody's time. So we're going to talk about some of the high-level items, methodology, the goals, and then the recommendations. And then if you want to get into details about specific rate strata or categories, we can do that as well. Starting off, we're waiting for this to synchronize. Based on the last presentation, are there any questions that stand out? I know you,
Mr. Campion.
I was just going to ask about the meter rates because I asked last time, and I still don't understand the structure. So at some point, I don't know if we're going to go through the generalities of the presentation, but I still see like a weird. There's like a double hump in our structure, and I'd expect it like. To go linearly down or linearly up, but we get like a weird habit where the 30-minute meter costs $1.70, the 2-hour meter costs $2.80, and then the 3-hour meter costs $1.70 again. And I don't really understand why this isn't just linear, I guess.
Sure, and then it could be simplified. We discussed various meters in different areas coming on and offline, which were going to impact the demand.
Sure.
But and they're priced differently, so that's why it isn't as linear. So you have, and what we talked about before is trying to put it, present it in a way that's based on a common unit of measurement. So per hour versus.
That was my question. These are all per hour then.
These are per hour costs.
For real.
Filling the yes, and it would be
okay.
a key factor is that different than the meters that are out front where you can put coins in. This would be have an automated function or a mobile app function, so payment would be made easier. That's one of the recommendations within our report is that before on-street meter rates are materially increased or increased in a way that is in line with our recommendations, there needs to be the proper equipment in place to handle that. And many communities are going through that right now. They know they want to value price the on-street meter locations. But they don't have all the equipment in place to be able to accommodate the rate increases. It would just be inconvenient from a collection standpoint as well as a user, and more importantly, the user standpoint bringing change. So,
yeah, it should be said. Okay. Just want to bring it up.
All right. Great. So, the focus of our study was around some guiding principles. The main reason why rates were being examined is because there were capital improvement projects that are being considered, and whenever the expenses increase for utility, there needs to be a source of revenue to service those expenses, whether it's operating expenses or borrowed capital, debt service. So the driver is not simply to generate more revenue, but to generate revenue that goes into an investment infrastructure that will support the economic development of downtown and ease of access for users to the downtown. Some of the guiding principles included simplifying the rate structure. There are several different rates, and we'll get into that. And we wanted to simplify it for the user as well as from the operations standpoint. We wanted to think about the Destination Medical Center Master Plan and what the vision is collectively for that in the future downtown and making sure there's access and we're using the resources to the fullest potential. So there's access to supply and access to downtown. So applying smart parking management objectives, which means having a proper balance between short-term and long-term parking. We also had a desire expressed to us to add transient capacity, short-term capacity for merchants, retailers, downtown, restaurants. Make sure that the spaces aren't consumed the majority of the day by employees only, that there were opportunities for visitors to park on-street and off-street. Increased contract rates, that's part of the smart parking management. Nothing is free. And we looked at the contract rates, and we looked at the rates in relation to all-day parking. And we developed a guiding principle for the department to use going forward, which is to get the monthly permits at about 80% of what it would cost if you paid the daily rate for 20 days. Provide sufficient revenue for ongoing operating expenses. That's a given. That's one of the guiding principles that's in the charter. We have to maintain solvency for the enterprise. We also want the city to flourish and use the TIF for non-parking related aspects of development. And so reliance on the TIF is going to decrease and eventually go away. So that was conveyed to us, and we looked at the budgets and said, okay, how are we going to replace that revenue stream? And then future funding requirements for infrastructure. We're looking at approximately $60 million worth of infrastructure, and how will that be paid for? So guiding principle was making sure that the system would be financially solvent. Just to give you historical perspective, roughly the net revenue is about $2.5 million. That's after expenses right now. So just to get an understanding of the parking enterprise, what it's generating. I won't get into the details there. Our primary recommendations follow the key principles that I outlined, as well as just highlighting here again, simplification of rates. We want the revenue for the lots, the on-street meters, citations, ramps, all to be incorporated into our financial model, so we built that in. We want to also be mindful of the five-year goal for the 80%, so that's also factored in, 80% of contract parkers. 80% of the rate is equal to, the contract parking is 80% of the all-day rate, so that's factored in. So the rate recommendations that you'll see reflect that principle. Just to give you a comparison quickly here of what exists and what we are recommending. What exists is on the left-hand side, and as you can see, there are approximately 20 rate categories. We're looking at consolidating down to a essentially four that would be presented at the entry of the lots and the parking ramps. We looked at an alternate case and a base case. The alternate case differs from the base in that you have event parking and evenings and weekends factored in there as well. With the alternate or the base, it's as is conditions. We just adjusted the increments charged. But as you can see down on the lower right-hand corner, that would be a sample sign for parking rates at the facilities.
We have a question here, quick.
Yep. Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, and I appreciate the interest in simplifying it. Mm-hmm. But so the recommendation is then, for after the initial first hour free, to go $2 an hour.
Correct.
It doesn't seem like it'd be that much of a complication just to keep it at that 30-minute increment, so $1 for each additional 30 minutes. I think people would feel that's a lot more equitable, and again, I don't think it throws out the whole simplification. Doesn't seem like a 30-minute increment would be that hard to
equitable in
well, I think when people go a minute over, if they get charged for an hour, it feels like, huh. Whereas they get 30 minutes to go, that's just the way it goes. 15-minute increment would probably be better, but that's probably going away from your simplification. So if we got 30 minutes now, so I can live with that.
You're thinking 30 minutes from the perception of the user.
If I was parking, that's what I'd want. So that's what I'm trying to advocate for.
60 is maybe too
granular. We need a little finer granulation there.
Okay. Sure. One of the exercises we did during the process of this full evaluation was, what is that worth? If it was 30, that 30 minutes extra that's being given as a courtesy, that grace time, what's the value of that number? And so feedback that we received through the process internally was that 60 minutes would be generous. Would support the downtown economic development and the patrons coming downtown. But you're right, that's worth considering.
And just to be clear, I'm not talking about the first hour. I'm talking about the subsequent hours. If you go over the next hour, instead of 1 to 2 hours, is $4. It'd be dollar per half hour. So it'd be the first 60 minutes free, just as it is on this chart. Mm-hmm. Then instead of $2 for each additional hour, it'd just be $1 for each additional half hour. So it's the same, more or less. There'll be some loss. But
you're going back and you're charging for that hour because you tripped that.
He's saying your increments on here are an hour.
Yeah.
He wants increments of 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, so much.
Yeah, I mean, we
that's essentially what we have now, right?
We can show that. As long as the increment charged it still comes out to be the same. It's just communicated more granularly. So if I stayed in a half-hour increment, it will tell me what that amount would be. Is that what you're stating?
So help me out. If I stay 61 minutes, what do I pay?
That'd be $4.
All right.
Because you've gone into that. You've exceeded the grace time.
Right. So just charge me $2, and then when I get to the next hour, charge me another $2, but do it in half-hour increments. So it's the same thing, it's just in half-hour increments.
Everything's based on 30 minutes. So
right.
60. No, so you want to run.
So you charge charge $1 for the first 30 minutes, $2 for the first hour.
It does affect the revenue projections in that average. The numbers that we provided to Phil and his team were based on the number of parkers within those rate bands.
We'd have to make an assumption.
Whether it's life or death, or it's something to do.
Yeah, so I'd ask the council if that's the direction we want to go, that we'd want to just rerun the pro formas to make sure if there's any difference.
I'm not married or opposed to that. I would simply say that at this point, I don't know if we necessarily want to go back and do more cases because we're trying to move this along. But
sorry, I just don't.
Go ahead.
I don't know what this involves, because I would guess this is like
a spreadsheet
update, but tell me if I'm wrong.
What the impact is either, because we're counting so many parkers within a certain rate band. That's how our data comes up.
I don't particularly find it critical, but if it makes it amenable to more people,
The challenge, it isn't a spreadsheet, and so from a modeling standpoint, it's fairly straightforward. As far as the credibility of the data, we don't have historical data based on the half-hour increment.
There you go. Okay.
So that would be an assumption that would have to be made based on.
Isn't that what we have right now?
With linear.
I mean, that's. It looks like what we have now, right?
Or
am I on the left?
I'm not sure we have that data.
Center Street has it. Center Street is that, and. So every day we sort things into 21 different rates and make a spreadsheet that's four screens long.
So but, it just seems more similar to what we're doing now.
But the other parking ramps do not have that data.
Mm. There.
So we could extrapolate off of one sample set or what we have.
If,
so current rate for 61 minutes is $3.50. So if that became $4 at 61 minutes, and then as soon as you went another half hour, you went to 5, the only thing that would do is possibly increase revenue if you did that. And as long as you keep even dollar amounts and we get rid of the 50 cents,
right.
That's a change-making nightmare operationally. So even dollar amounts, it doesn't matter to operations. You'll have more money if you start at 4 and then go to 5, 6 instead of $2 amounts. The sign doesn't take any more lines to go 30-minute increments.
So what's the consensus of the council? Do you want to look at that additional granularity or kind of go with what's being proposed here, at least for the moment, Mr. Hickey?
And either I'm not understanding or I'm not communicating. So right now, it's first 60 minutes is free. And we're, after that, we're going to go $2 per hour when you go over 60 minutes, right?
No, it's going to be $4 at 61 minutes, right?
For 2 hours. So what I'm saying is, let's split it out. Instead of $4 for 2 hours, say $1 per half hour. So if you go 61 minutes, it's $2. You know, if you go over the next full, you know, half hour, every half hour is $1.
So rate decrease?
Oh. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm arguing. I'm not trying to argue with
you. Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is complicated.
You're right.
From a revenue capture perspective, I think the reason, just to give you insight into the analysis, going to 4 right away versus having staggered increment, you do have greater revenue capture. But to your point, is it equitable? You know, for someone who stays over, it would be $2 versus $4 if they stay beyond in half-hour increments. We're saying as soon as it trips over that $1, that 1 hour, that 60 minutes, it goes to the full amount of $4. $2 each additional hour.
Ms. Johnson, you got a question?
No, I just wanted clarification. What I'm hearing is that up to the second hour, between hour 1 and hour 2, it's $4. And then what the proposal is, every 30 minutes after that is $1 per 30 minutes. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, and I probably misstated the case for the first hour. So essentially the first hour is still $2. So you get the first hour free. Once you go over 61 minutes, then it's $3 in that half-hour increment.
The system for the free hour is really, it's only free if you're
right.
Helped.
And that's what our current system is. Right, and that's, so I'm not suggesting we change that.
But what you're, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to like help. Like, so what you're saying is when you get to hour 2.5, then it should be $5 instead of $6.
Yes.
That's what I'm hearing.
Just over 2 as opposed to.
Okay. That's what I'm hearing. I don't know if that's what everybody else is hearing. Yep. Okay.
He's basically going $1 per 30 minutes. Well,
I believe we have sufficiently demonstrated that the math is too hard.
So, to your point, that can be done. It's just we need to receive that direction, whether you want that analysis performed in that 30 minute, just to see the difference of what the net revenue collected would be. And then you can weigh it from a policy perspective.
Right.
I'd like to see it.
So that was my question. What's the consensus of the council? You want to add that, look at that additional granularity,
sure,
and see how what the forecast looks like or
what
not.
What does the revenue?
Mr. Wojcik.
I would say that if we actually have the data to do that, it sounds like we have that at the Center Street ramp and not the other ramps. And the caveat is the Center Street ramp does not function like the other ramps, so I really don't think that data is out there. I would think that would have to be like a follow-on to this, because we truly do not have that data in the other places.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I guess I'm just going by the chart. When it says we've got a current 30-minute increment in the other ramps, we just don't capture what we're doing, or why wouldn't we have this data? That's the current rate structure, is 30 minutes.
That's because it flattens out. Center Street keeps on going with the half-hour increments, but if you look down the line, you have like 4 or 5 hours, then you have 5 to 9 hours. So it's within the first 3 hours, it's fine, but after that, it flattens out at the other ramps.
Maybe let me ask another question to staff. How many hours of staff time would it take to come up with the alternate scenario?
Well, that's a guess.
You mean prepare this analysis?
Yeah,
put them on consultant time, like maybe 2 hours, an hour to do and an hour to quality check.
I can give you that much.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, I'm willing to look at it as long as there's not a great investment in time to do the analysis, Mr. Kim.
Can I say that as well? Like, can we go forward pretending we're not going to do that for the rest of the presentation so we don't have to caveat everything?
Yeah, I agree.
All right.
So we'll provide that.
Right. Thank you. Okay, and what we wanted to do...
Just as a memo. Can we just do it as a memo, and then we'll see it before this comes forward to us for some sort of action?
That would work.
Okay. I'm going to get into our contract parking. Talk about hourly there. You know, our five-year goal, increased contract rates, 80% of the all-day rate, which is approximately the 9 to 10-hour strata. That's offering a 20% discount, and it aligns with industry best practices. And what we are trying to do here is establish some consistency in how the department would go about setting rates. We know that within parking systems, it can become a tapestry, a quilt of different policies and special arrangements, and you can have contracts for different tenants downtown for parking, and pretty soon you end up with several policies that sometimes don't end up being equitable. You know, you get one tenant looking wires, another tenant getting a different rate structure. So we're trying to create consistency. And just to give you perspective on how current ramps compare to the 20% discount goal, of the all-day. Center Street's 43% right now discount for monthly. Civic Center, 72. First Street Ramp, 63. You have 52 and 52 for second and third. So you can see that there's a significant discount given for monthly parkers, as opposed to if they were going to pay all day. So we just want to bring that a little closer in line so that the discount is no longer roughly 43 to 72. We're looking at it closer to 20%. The contract rates, we looked once again at base case and alternate. And
we have a question here, Ms. Johnson.
Can you go back to that last slide, please?
Sure.
Does that say how much the revenue would increase by changing the discount to 20% versus what's there?
We can get to that if you'd like.
Okay.
Yeah, we do have that calculation, what it would be.
Okay.
And so the rate recommendations that we have for contract reflect bringing them closer to 20. Now, they're not always exact because we're looking at whole numbers and it's a modeling exercise, but we do bring them closer. We also looked at elasticity of demand factored in when we were looking at different properties and different rates and how it would impact the tenants.
Okay. And then
we do have the difference between what is currently generated and what would be generated.
Okay, and then with the number of current spaces that we contract out, what percentage, do you know what percentage that is that are contract parking versus the entire?
Or percentage of the total supply?
Yes.
We have approximately 2,000 contract parkers, 5,300 spaces downtown, but there's 3,000 spaces in the ramps. So that's.
And we're at 1512 now for contract workers.
1512, so the mail. So 1500 of the 3,000 ramp spaces. So half of that.
Okay, thank you.
here is just a 5-year schedule.
No, you're good.
Pardon? Okay. So, as you can see, what we have here in the base case are rates that are by category. So, for example, if you're a commercial 24/7 patron, it's $170 a month now. In 18, it would go to 190. In 19, 224. 270, 315, 352. That's one example. Random is 105, and that takes it up to 288. And I'm just presenting this at a high level, but these are the inputs that go into our financial projections. And that's what we talked about having the council consider now. We talked about the methodology for setting those rates. And one may ask, well, why are those increasing at that click, at that adjustment? Well, it's a function of what the hourly rates are. So when hourly rates are going up, we're still trying to keep up with that 20% discount at hourly. So as hourly rates go up, the monthly is going up as well. Mm-hmm. And it's staying within the designed relationship of 20% discount. So that's how, that's what's driving the escalation.
Just conceptually, not only do we want to, care about the relative price that the different ones are paying, but we also want to make sure all of our parking spots are not taken up by just all-day car storage. Do we generally believe that these rates are such that this will balance the demand and supply of our contract parking spots? Are we limiting the contract parking spots?
It's definitely moving into that direction.
Okay.
Much closer than we are right now today. The operator can speak to this, the director can speak to this. Parking is one of those industries where you can change rates and see the elasticity of demand within days. So what we do is we advise that those rate changes you'd also need to monitor units sold and changing behavior. Not only people leaving the system, going to an alternative mode of transportation, taking park and ride, but also maybe switching to another facility or a lower cost option within the system.
Well, that's one of my concerns, is just that for most of us, parking is elastic, but there is a segment, especially here in Rochester, that doesn't matter what you price that all-day contract parking at. Yeah. They'll pay $1,000 a month to have the spot, and that's certainly not me. What I hate to do is get to a circumstance where those are the only people that have the spots.
Understood. Well, what we're trying to do too in this policy is create choice. So if somebody sees the monthly price at a rate point where they feel it's unacceptable and they don't want to include that in their budget, they could always pay as needed if they weren't downtown every single day, depending on the nature of their business. So they do have the daily option. And to your point, about 50% of the supply open to use by transient patrons. That's available supply that can be used for daily users. Okay.
Mr. Campy,
the daytime rate, is there a matching? I mean, one of the other experiments I've been hearing about for parking balancing is trying to convince employers to go to a non-standard work hour to shift people out of the key window when parking is at such a demand. Is that what the daytime is supposed to be partnered with, or the daytime looks like it goes from 5 a.m. to 2 a.m.? So I don't understand whether that three-hour window is really critical to us, or who's that critical to?
Well, I recall when we were discussing the rates, we were looking at that all-day marker. They are paying a premium, where the short-term marker is paying less. Employer shifted their start times to, say, 10 to 8. I suppose there would be some savings because they wouldn't get into that 8 and 9 hour parking of 4 or 5. So.
Yeah, typically, the shift is mainly to, for example, universities often shift their academic schedule because they know that 15 15 increment or a 30 minute increment of overlap between classes can result in the need of a substantial amount of supply, and they shifted, they just, you know, redistribute the demand, and they can save having to build. So employers sometimes will say, yes, during the daytime, or in the morning at 10 a.m., it's peak time, and peak occupancy occurs. Therefore, we're going to shift our hours so that you have access to work. It really has little to do with payment and more to do with access.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So I presented this last time, and you know, going to the flat lots, different from the parking ramps, we have our transient rates, dollar rate increase in year one, dollar rate increase in years three and five. Now, this would be, you know, our lower cost option. You always want to have an alternative within a system. So those who park in flat lots, pay a lower daily rate, and then contract rates for those same facilities. And we're looking at a rate increase in year one, but $20 rate increase at most of the lots. So from a percentage standpoint, it may seem significant, but when you look at the what it costs to park in some of the other facilities, we feel that it's realistic and that those lots may have been undervalued over the years. Any questions about flat lots? Okay. We talked about meter rates, and you know, we'll continue to simplify that. But the meter rates are broken down into categories of 30-minute, 90-minute, 2-hour, 3-hour, and 10-hour. We had a number of meters that offered those rate categories within our model. The rates that are shown were included. And enforcement and citation rates, you know, we recommend that you know, over time, over the projection period, focusing on expired meters, which is the largest category of citations, taking them from 17 to 30. $17 in 2017, 2018, 2020, keeping it flat until 2020, and then you're at $25 flat for 21, and then to 30 in 2022. And it's important to note $12 state tax paid on each ticket. So it's not that the city receives full amount of that. There is a portion that goes to the state. And there is a loss right now within that category. And so the goal is to try to bring it to positive cash flow break even. Now, there's always a paradox with that. This is citations and enforcement. We want people to follow and not be cited with the citation, follow the rules. It's the intention is to change human behavior so the system can function and more people can be served and there aren't violators. So when projecting this, we're always careful to be conservative and not overstate revenue gains from citations.
In your projections, I assume you're factoring in the law enforcement time and costs in terms of the enforcement. Are we also factoring in the amount of time that the city clerk's office deals with some of this?
We have that.
Okay.
And we're going to provide a mail. That question came up.
All right.
Councilman Hickey. And so we're working on some data for that and also showing the transition. I think we're at over 50% of citations now are paid online or by phone. The residential permits, though, about 80% of those are still covered.
Mr. Campion?
I'm assuming our city clerk, it takes less time for your staff to deal with ones that are paid online?
Yes, although we still deal with all the inquiries associated with that. You know, it's certainly a big help, though.
I think the council should consider in the future just financially incentivizing people online for payment and making sure that we're doing that, unless you are already.
Well, we talked with, I think it's Fargo that decided to take out the convenience fee. And in other words, because there is a convenience fee for paying online or on the web. It's like
way. I want the convenience to be you walk up to the desk. That should be where the convenience fee is, because that's costing us all the time.
Understand, okay.
Does that make sense to anyone else?
Yes.
If that is actually what's costing us time, then let's just make sure we're covering
it. Incentive to use the online.
Right.
Not, I mean, maybe we have certain classes of individuals who are unable to do that, and we can figure out how to make an exception, but generally speaking, I mean, if 50% are already doing it, and we can get that up to 85, we can probably save some staff time, I guess. Okay, I rest my case.
Yeah, there are departments that are their goal is typically around 80%. If they know that 20%, they'll be in any circumstances. But you can create the push-pull with behavior by putting policies in place.
Sure.
Okay. So residential permits, it's a small number in the budget, but we did take a look at the number of applications, actual permits out there, the types of permits, and our recommendations are to increase rates by $5 in the first year, and in 2020, another $5. So we're looking at residential permits going up by 10. Right now they're 20, so it'd be 30 at the end of the projection year.
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, so this is the one that I had the question last time. So it's with the automated license plate readers, and the fact we don't issue physical placards anymore, I would think our cost on this would be, as a minimum, be flat. I would say, I would have to guess our cost to administer this program has gone down with the, again, license plate readers, and we're not issuing placards. So it seems like a pretty big jump for something that's costing us less money to operate.
Yeah, we're still doing, 80% of the permits are still purchased across the counter, and not sure why. 20% can be purchased.
Could you say the permit? So they put it in their window and a meter
It's license plate driven.
Right.
And so enforcement is, that does speed up. Go down the street now and read the plate. And
right.
And you're either in or out. You know, but as far as a breakout on cost, I'd have to look at that. I don't think that we split the clerk's time or enforcements by enforcement of the residential permits and regular citations. So that's all mixed in there. And it's about $500,000 a year. Looking at the labor for both of them, well, they're pretty consistent the last 3 years. So I don't have an answer for you.
Okay.
On the residential. So we've been looking at it.
Okay. Mr. Bilderbeck.
Tony, does that take into the account of purchase of the equipment?
That's part of the capital budget.
Yeah, I believe so. I have to.
Okay.
So in the records, is it allocated specifically to the permit, or is it part of the system, a capital improvement for the system? Do you know if it's broken down?
Go ahead. I'll that.
Okay.
The LPR units are about almost $40,000 a car. And we may have, that may have been charged to the capital program. But the ongoing software license and supplies for that's in the operating budget.
Okay. So I see. To put that in context, in 2017 we're at just about $40,000 in residential permit revenue. So payback takes time. As I mentioned, it's a small number relative to the budget, overall budget. So 5-year pro forma, putting this all together, what does it look like? We're projecting growth in demand, which is going to drive the use of the facilities. And the use of the facilities is going to change slightly. So that's important because you look at the parking system as a business model, and you generate revenue from short-term, from monthly contract parkers on street, residential permit program, citations, and we have the number of units sold for monthly parking slightly decreasing, and the space available for short-term parking increasing. And so short-term parking typically has a larger margin on seeing growth. Our projections are showing, you know, historically, I mentioned roughly $2.5 million in net income now. With this rate schedule, and even factoring in elasticity of demand, some shift in loss of units sold, going to other modes or lower cost products, we have a projected net income of $6.5 million. And then, you know, back to the question of, well, why? Why are we generating this type of net income? And the answer is, you know, we're looking at adding significant capital improvements over the next 5 years. $60 million in general obligation revenue bonds for new parking ramps. And so what we did is we calculated the debt service for $30 million at 4.5% interest rate over a 20-year term. And it's roughly, we're looking at a debt coverage on that of 1.27. When we work with municipalities and utility, specifically public utilities, it all depends on the way that the financial policies are dictated. But having it at minimum, a 1.1 coverage ratio is the lowest we see. The highest, some communities require a 1.5 debt coverage ratio for the utility, just to make sure there's adequate cushion there to cover any slowdown in the economy. All it takes is a tenant leaving, or a certain event's not being rebooked in the community for demand to change. So parking is very susceptible to adjustments in the market. So what we have here are projections with the first round of debt of 1.27 to 2.84. When we add the next layer of debt, the next $30 million, that brings it down. Starting at the same in 2018 at 2.7, because that's just the first round. We'll be 2019 is the same, the first round only. In 2020, we have the second layer of debt coming online. That brings the coverage to 1.04. So under the base case, you're close to breaking even as a utility, being able to pay the debt service as well as the ongoing operating expenses and other capital improvement and maintenance items. In 2021, it goes to 1.01, and that's in part because of our rate schedule. We don't have it for all the categories going up every year, every 2 years. So you see a margin compression essentially in 2021, and then rates are increased in 2022, and we see an uptick to 1.42.
Just one minor interjection: we are currently not on pace to do that debt issuance in 18 or 19. So I suppose what's on going.
And that can be calibrated. I think for the purpose of just stress testing the system and seeing what it could bear, those were inputs we received at the time. But So, in summary, here's the 5-year performance of the base case. We're not going to get into the alternative. If you have any questions, glad to ask now, or we can follow up with you if you'd like that other analysis done. We can do that too.
Yep, so we're planning to do that. We're planning to do the analysis.
Do you have the last slide? So one of the questions will be for Council, Professor Council. Actually,
we'll maybe if we can hold back, let's hold off on that. Yeah. Because then we can evaluate and answer those questions.
That would be good. All right. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Campion?
Yeah, so obviously we need solvency, and that last chart shows, I'm just going to ballpark it, about two-thirds of new revenue being consumed by potential debt issuances, of which I know we have some plans for additional ramp projects. The remainder, does that make us solvent in terms of replacement of existing ramp assets? Has that analysis been done?
Well, the capital program that was used to analyze that included the restoration projects.
Okay, so there's no surprises down the road. This is covered. We're getting two new ramps, and all of our existing ramps maintenance problems are covered.
That's correct.
Perfect.
We have the CIP included.
All right, thank you.
Do we do a payment in lieu of taxes then out of there?
That's in our operating.
It is. Okay, perfect. What is the implementation date of this, hypothetically, actually getting the rates out there?
That was the slide we're not going to get into right now.
So I'll touch on it. So you've seen across the top of these, 2017, 2018, we're obviously getting late into 2018. So I'd suggest looking at year one, year two, year three. So when we come back to council, most likely we'll be coming back with a January 1, 2019 implementation date.
All right. Anything else? Mr. Woodger.
So, just wanted to, there was, on this topic, we're moving on. So,
I'm sorry?
This topic, we're moving on.
Well, any other?
I don't have anything
on this
topic. I'm exhausted on this topic.
All right.
I'm beaten down.
We will move on to our next topic for this afternoon, which is the Heritage Preservation Committee update. Brent, you're going to step us through this?
I just want to give you a quick update on the HPC and the issues.
Go ahead.
I just want to give you a quick update on the HPC and three issues recently before the HPC. The first issue is that of the downtown district. All three members back on June 5th of last year, the council approved PBN to conduct a local designation study for a potential landmark district in the downtown. The HPC has reviewed multiple draft versions of the study at some of the recent meetings, and in June, the HPC found that the study was in a final form to proceed with the next steps for that downtown district. So staff wanted to update the council before taking these next steps. So the next step that the HPC will do is that they will hold open houses and educational sessions on this study. And we're looking at sometime in September, October. And then part of that, we will invite the property owners within the district so that they can learn about that district and what that would mean for their property if they are located within the district and if they are a contributing or a non-contributing property. So after they have the open houses and the educational sessions, the HPC will have a public hearing on the potential district. And after that hearing, the HPC would make a recommendation to the city council on the district. And then the city council would have a public hearing on the local downtown historic district. So just to give you a location of the potential district, you can see it here on the map. There's 40 properties located within the proposed district. 31 of those properties would be considered contributing properties to the district, and 9 properties would be considered not contributing to the district. So what that would mean for...
Brent, we have a question here. Ms. Johnson?
He might have been getting to it.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, is the non-contributing properties that are just too new to fit into that, or are there landowners that do not want to participate?
No, they're newer developments. They didn't fit into the time frame of the significance of the district.
Perfect. Okay,
which
thank
was
you.
Like 1870-something to 1962. Okay. So what that would mean for those properties that are considered a contributing property, as the ordinance is written now, anytime a property owner would want to do any type of exterior work on the building other than minor maintenance stuff, they would have to come to the HPC and council for approval of the work they're proposing on their property. So this was the first subject I want to talk to you guys about today. The second one is the challenge property list. So back in February of last year, the council adopted a list of potential landmark properties, and that was based on work done by the 106 group that narrowed down the start list that had over 500 properties down to a list of properties that were potentially historic properties. Back in January, February of 2017, at that time, Mayor Reeves had sent out proper notices to all the properties that were being considered as potential landmark properties, giving those owners opportunities to come to informational meetings. At that time, 26 property owners stated that they intended to challenge their designation of, as being a potential landmark properties. So those properties were put on the so-called challenge property list, and the intent of that time was that the HPC would review the properties at their meetings and to allow for more information from the property owners, and then at that time you could decide if that property should be on the potential list or if it should be taken off the list altogether. So far, one property has been removed from that list. I think in that case, the HPC had recommended that it be moved to the potential list. That property owner appealed that decision, and the decision came to the council. I think it was late last year. So just recently, the HPC members are evaluating the 26 properties found on that challenge list, and then we're going to put them, all their evaluations together to see which properties they feel are the highest priority on that challenge list. And then the HPC will start having public hearings on those properties on the challenge list to see if they should be either removed from the list altogether or moved over to the potential property list.
Mr. Bilderbeck?
So if a property owner says they don't want to be on, and they have the hearing, and the HPC says they should remain on, what happens?
They could appeal that decision to the council and come to the city council.
Mr. Hickey?
Can you remind me, the challenge properties category, is that in our current ordinance? Is this just kind of an interim classification still while we're getting things in order?
There's not, challenge property is not addressed in our ordinance.
Okay.
So the properties that are on this challenge list has no protection against them, so the owner can do what they want on their property.
Okay.
So that's why we're going through that, evaluating these properties now to determine which ones are the highest priority for the HPC members. So we can start looking at those properties first to see if they should be on the potential list. And that way that would afford that, or there would be some protections against that property if it was on the potential list, because anytime they want to do something, that would come to the HPC and the council for approval.
All right, thank you.
The last subject is just an update on the ordinance update. If the council members back on May 7th, the council, based on a request from the HPC, directed the city attorney to prepare an ordinance that would require review by the commission and council any demo or building permit for exterior work filed on a property listed on the potential landmark list, the so-called challenge list, and any property included in the draft plan of the downtown landmark district. The city attorney has prepared language that would address the properties that are on the potential list, but that does not, language does not address those properties on the challenge list or those properties in the so-called proposed downtown district list. And the reasons for that is those properties that are on the challenge list, they have not had their due process yet because they were never given the opportunity to speak during a public hearing when the council created the potential list.
Okay. Mr. Campion.
Who's allowed to challenge?
A challenged what for?
I mean, we call it a challenge list. Who is responsible for challenging?
Well, there's, there's 26 properties on the challenge list.
Yep.
So those properties, owners.
Okay, where is that process called out?
It's not called out in the ordinance at all.
Okay.
So that's why we're trying to...
So here's my problem. We've called... Sorry, I'm cutting you off, and that's not appropriate. But here's my problem, is we call this... we say their due process has not been given. They don't have any due process. We don't have actually... They don't mean anything. We're putting them on a superfluous list. I don't understand the idea that their due process might be violated.
I'll let the city attorney answer that. But
well, if you put restrictions on that property without having any sort of hearing or ability for them to hear it, right now it's not a problem because there's no restrictions on the property.
Right. So they okay. We're proposing them for something. They're being put on a potential list. So what we're saying now is like there should be due process prior to be placed on a potential list, even.
Well, which.
I'm changing it so that they're either on the potential list or they're a landmark or they're nothing. So.
Okay, okay. Maybe I'm okay with that. This challenge list is artificial, and I get it, but
ephemeral lists that just kind of join up, then people start going, well, where are we at? And that comes in later, and we have to sync up different versions of the language and what staff came up with. So I just want to make sure, like, my understanding is the only due process that would exist would be when we review the application for landmark designation. Going on a potential or other list, there's no due process because of the point of the regulation is at the time it transfers to being a landmark.
Unless you want to try and put restrictions on their property when it's on the potential list.
Okay. All right. Thank you for explaining
that. So, you know, maybe just to add on to that, if there's a, at some point we had a general review if there was a demolition permit done on any property beyond a certain age, I think. Is that, again, stepping on their rights by just review? If it's consistent across all properties, if they're of a certain age, we review them? Or is that fair to just continue to do that?
I wasn't aware of that.
Okay. I think that's what it was, wasn't it?
No, it was any of those properties that were on the start list.
Oh, the start list.
Yep.
Okay.
And then that start list was narrowed down to the potential list.
Yeah.
So I think the ordinance that Jason had proposed would have triggered that if a demo permit was filed on any of those properties on that potential list, or a landmark property would come before the council.
So,
and the HPC.
I have a couple higher level questions that it's incredibly two things I know about the current status of preservation in Rochester. One is that there is no broad community consensus on what should be done here. There's not even a council consensus on it. So it ends up going to votes, but that leaves everyone in a very precipitous situation because, you know, you're dealing with a divided community and divided council. The second thing I know is that there are no property rights issues here because the Supreme Court has laid out quite clearly what communities may and may not do, and our ordinance does not step upon the what the Supreme Court has laid out. I do think a more fundamental step in addressing all of these is we have to, as a council, speak as to whether a downtown historic district is something that we want for the community. And I think that's something that should probably be brought up for a vote in plain view of everyone, because if we're willing to make it look like we're doing something, but we're not listening to experts every step of the way, all we're doing is we're wasting everybody's time and frustrating everybody. So at some point, this has to really come to the council for a decision, and I don't think that's happened yet. But, you know, if it requires a couple council members introducing something to, you know, reaffirm the position or something, that's good. My understanding is when we get that memo from the consultant who looked at whether or not we had a case for a downtown historic district, their conclusion was, yeah, actually, it probably will qualify for the National Register. It's so good. You know, if we're going to ignore that, I'd like to cut all of this off at the beginning and save a lot of staff time, because at some point we really have to decide if we're going to do this or not, because there are some property owners that don't agree with this, and we just have to figure out if this is going to be a community priority or not. And then, you know, lastly, in terms of facilitating some of this, the nuts and bolts of I imagine there'll be some point we go through an ordinance or something in more detail than today, but the nuts and bolts of some of the things like the like the fees, for example, to nominate properties. I do think we need to clearly communicate what those fees cover and when they're applicable and when they're not applicable. But one thing in terms of creating a downtown historic district, I would like to see, you know, if that's a route that the council does decide to go, and that's yet to be seen, I think we want to do that as a bundled project at that point and be looking for, you know, some internal funding to do those. So those were kind of my two cents on the big picture things.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, this is good. This is just what I was going to ask for the staff to go back to this. I thought the staff had laid out the next steps, including public hearings, then forwarding to the council. So it didn't seem like it was stuck. It seems like they're laying out a kind of a systematic process here.
Yeah, I think we just wanted to bring it to the council's attention before we send out letters to these property owners, and you guys get a call from property owners of what is this downtown district. I wanted to make you aware of that it was coming up.
Well, and my biggest concern is that, you know, if we're going to follow, you know, if we're interested in the recommendations of the professional staff consultants that have looked at this and what's coming from the, you know, from our commissions, that's one thing. But if this is just an exercise in futility, I'd really rather have that fight up front and make decisions after that.
Mr. Bilbeck.
I think it's also important that we understand if we do a downtown district, what's the restrictions on non-conforming properties, if any, especially when you're talking about what kind of impact they may have on a historical designated air property. So I think that's important too, because that's going to have, we'll have the input then from those who are owners of non-conforming if there's restrictions placed on them. So it would be good to know what they are up front.
Well, I mean, I think the point of bringing this to you, to come from Wojcik's point, is if this is too far ahead of where the council wants to be, right. You know, it's an opportunity for you to say that, and then the HBC can digest that information. Because we anticipate there's going to be a lot of community conversation and property owner conversation generated when the letter goes out and says, right. By the way, you're going to be on the, you know, potentially the downtown historic district and you're contributing property. And it will mean some potential future limitations on your ability to make adjustments to your property if you are put on that list. No different, really. A lot of the similar concepts will apply as if you're designated as a landmark property. And so it is a new initiative. I think, you know, we're just trying to understand, you know, if the council would like us to go through this process to kind of get affirmation on that, because HPC is very interested in doing that. And, you know, it's been an important conversation. I think the three things that are presented here tonight are good things, so the HPC can have their focus. We've had this challenge list out there for a while, and we need to start making our way through that and determine, you know, that status, so people aren't frustrated about what is or isn't happening if you're on that list. So we can kind of have some clear definition or resolution on that. And I think to the point earlier with the question on the ordinance in terms of the specific details, that's a draft that was prepared last week. The HPC will review that next, okay. And then ultimately make a recommendation to you to then show how, you know, what status those potential landmark properties will have and what adjustments will be made there. So there's a number of things here, but as we've had a lot of conversations on preservation in Rochester, we really needed to get together and sort of tighten up the work plan a little bit, given what we have for staffing resources and where, you know, the council wants to go. And we just want to really be intentional about our efforts, so we're going in directions that everybody's on board with.
Okay. And I agree with that, but again, I just think it's important, because when you start having those meetings, those ideas of what happens to a non-conforming property and if they name it a historic zone or not is going to be very, very important. So
I think that can be part of how we frame the issue when we do that outreach to people, to let them know the implications of that.
Yep, I just want to make sure you do that.
Okay, Mr. Campion.
I'm okay with the steps we've laid out. I would just ask that we have the communications director, someone, draft a note about why we're starting to pursue this, about how this matches some of our preservation goals, and maybe even cover what it, like an is not style column about what is this, what is it this not. I think if we can get that out there ahead of it so that people can reference that before, hopefully, we start scheduling all this and notifying all the property owners, then maybe we can hit some of that off. Yeah. But generally, I think the plan here looks like how we would go about it.
Okay. Anything else, Brent?
Oh, I have something.
Mr. Campion.
I've sent some suggestions to the city attorney specifically about language in 19B. I was a little bit frustrated at the last council meeting we had, where we had to go around 19B and talk specifically about a property qualifying based on some criteria. The ordinance, I think, does a clear job, but I think maybe the language could be clarified further, that it's not a set of, if you do this, then you are automatically a candidate. And I think that if we add language that clarifies the city's position based on at least the experience adjudicating these cases on the council, that there's a threshold test involved in this 19B section. I think I passed around some of the language, and I'll make sure the city administrator distributes the rest of the council. That clearly calls out that the idea of the extent to which it meets some of these criteria is actually a debatable concept for which the council and certainly the HPC can have a discussion. It's not a you know, there's no single checkbox. And I think some of the frustration has come from a seeming process that seems, a lot of people assume, stops the moment that there's a published report from a consultant, and that's the end-all, be-all of the process. Councilmember Wojcik's comments about ignoring it strike a little bit at some of my frustration about the last process. It's not that we're ignoring it, it's that we're looking at it in the broader context of the objectives of a preservation program. So a preservation program at Comet still lacks meaningful incentives. So I think there's a lot broader worldview that needs to go into that decision making than simple like check boxes that you meet this or you don't. And I would just hope as we draft versions of this document for further review, we continue to expound on the capacity and the necessity for a decision-making role of the council in the process.
Mr. Bilderbeck.
Do we have a timeline for when these steps will be carried out?
For the downtown district?
Well, for any of the next steps.
We're looking at September, October, having those open houses, and then once we have that, we can schedule the hearing before the HPC, and then once they make the recommendation, that would be forwarded on to the city council.
So probably by, at the latest, first quarter next year.
Hopefully by the end of the year, hopefully.
Good. Well, I didn't want to put you into a position.
Yeah.
You
know, that's what I'm planning to do.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else on this topic? Thank you for the update. All right. Any other questions for this afternoon? Mr. Wojcik.
I've got two, but I can get them done in under 2 minutes, I think. First item, staff did review the 16th Avenue information, if there was anything in any of our adopted plans that precluded what staff was recommended. They found none, so will that be back on the council agenda listed under tabled items at the next meeting?
Okay.
Second thing, I just wanted to, there was some lack of clarity, myself included, on you know, what went on last week with a private event, but I very much appreciate our two public safety chiefs being here, and just to keep things moving. Is it, Chief Kurska, is it fair to say when you learned the conditions surrounding the event that you agreed that would not be appropriate to participate?
Yes.
It feel the same way?
When I learned that the event was possibly or could be construed as politicized, I made the decision to back out.
Perfect. And I don't think that was entirely clear, so I thank you for bringing the clarity to that. And my only other point would be to the city administrator, are we effectively communicating, you know, the staff doing things in their official capacity versus, you know, in their private time, not official capacity, and what? Okay, perfect.
I think that was articulated earlier today in the memo that the city attorney sent out.
In part, parts of it were, but... No, I'm just glad that we're all on the same page, that this would not have been a, you know, a good event to be involved in.
Any other business? All right, hearing none.